Pause. There we go. She always asks me to pause. So I'm just going to jump right in. And if somebody wants to follow up on this, hopefully I can dial this in on my phone. We can talk about some of this stuff. So from my good friend, Jam. I'm sure you've talked about this before, but I have not listened to all the previous Q&As. Yeah, there's almost 3 years of them now, so no worries. Curious what you would say now. My question is, how has your nighttime dream yoga practice affected your daytime life? How is it affecting it now? What is your daytime dream practice like? Okay. Well, Jan, it's been nothing sort of, nothing short of monumental for me. It's why I'm so passionate about these, not just dream yoga, but the other four nocturnal meditations: liminal dreaming, lucid dreaming, sleep yoga, bardo yoga. But dream yoga is the central one, especially for Tibetan practitioners. And it has affected absolutely everything. I'll try to do my best to summarize some of the impacts. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to have dreams, like, you know, they sometimes call these theophantic dreams that are just like life-changing, right? Hyperlucid theophantic dream, where that dream is more real than this, that's a game changer. You just need one of these, and it really just changes everything, like a near-death experience, because you actually experience a dimension that seems more real than this. You wake up from that, this seems like the foggy dream. And so maybe just starting right there, that has been colossal, because what has happened with me, Jan, is that and some of you listening probably heard me say this previously, if you're very cautious with how you use the word reify to make real, to solidify, as one reifies, clarifies, stabilizes the dream, by immediate implication, you de-reify this. And that's why dream yoga is intimately connected with a diurnal daytime practice of illusory form, which is your second part. So as my nighttime dreams became more real, more stable, more clear, even than this becomes more like a dream. And I think that's actually could be an intimation of what it means to wake up in the spiritual sense, where you see the utter equanimous nature of all states of consciousness. And in fact, parenthetically along those lines, I know you're a very deep student of the Tibetan tradition. Kenpo Rinpoche said, right, based on a commentary that he wrote on Milarepa's teaching, not seeing day and dream as differing, this is as meditation as they can be. Well, what that really means, according to Kenpo Rinpoche, is that until you can meditate in your dreams as much as you, with the clarity, stability, and whatnot that you have during the day, your meditation is considered incomplete. So that has been colossal for me. Just last night, I had a battery of lucid dreams that were so cool. Every time I have these, it never gets old. They're just like, they're pretty, pretty amazing. So dreams, you know, prodromal dreams, predictive dreams, precognitive dreams. I've had dreams, again, that have impacted my life profoundly. And I don't live in an alternate universe, so I can't say what would have happened had I not acted on some of the kind of warnings I got from my dreams. But I've had very, very impactful precognitive dreams that were brought to full, complete fruition. In fact, this last year has been a non-trivial health issue. But it was completely predicted by one of the most impactful dreams of the last decade for me that I had 2 years ago. In fact, I'm in California, same place I was 2 years ago. This dream 2 years ago completely predicted everything that happened in the last year. And that allowed me, when it started to click, it was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what my dream was predicting. So therefore, I could negotiate and look back at that dream, which I dated, titled, and really studied. I could look back on that dream, and it really helped me with what I went through this last year. Again, there's so much to say here, Jan. I guess perhaps the most important thing is that by engaging in these dream yoga practices, natural meditations, it opens this bidirectionality that the insights from these two previously disparate states of, disparate states of consciousness, the waking state and the dreaming state, which are previously separate, you know, I've kind of hacked into the dream state, which were a previous restricted state of consciousness, and opened, playful language, this kind of interstate commerce. This is probably the most important thing. Where now, because I have such allegiance to the nocturnal mind, I respect my dreams as much as I do my waking reality. And in fact, this is one distinction between Eastern and Western philosophy. Western philosophy derives its views of mind and reality almost exclusively from the waking state. Eastern traditions derive their views of mind and reality from all three states. In fact, four, if you include the fourth state, Turiya, waking, dreaming, and deep dreamless sleep. So it's a much more integrated, holistic, comprehensive way of looking at mind and reality that's no longer so wake-centric, sight-centric, photocentric. But the bidirectionality is probably the biggest thing here, Jen, where insights now flow back and forth. So I have insights, I do my practices during the day, they pop up, ping up into my night time experience, they bring about more lucidity at night. And then the insights I have at night don't just stay under the blanket of darkness, they ping back in. They come back into my daily experience and they continue to inform, transform everything I do in this waking world. So I see the world as much less real, more like a dream. That doesn't mean I don't take it things seriously. That's the dismissive end of dreams. But taking things seriously does not follow that you have to take them literally. That's a mistake. And I think arguably the Buddha was the ultimate lucid dreamer. And I think this is an intimation of what it means to wake up, to realize the fluidity, the emptiness, the flexibility of mind and reality altogether. And so last thing on this, because I could run on this for the whole hour, is the dream arena has definitely given me greater insights into emptiness. So arguably the central teaching in all Buddhism. And Mingyur Rinpoche says this, right? The nighttime classroom is an easier classroom for emptiness than the daytime arena. And that's what all the stages of dream yoga are about, progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. And so that's probably the biggest thing. More and more insight, stability is an interesting word when you talk about emptiness, but more insight into the nature of emptiness, the bidirectionality, replacing a previously vicious circle of non-lucidity with a virtuous circle of lucidity where this interstate traffic flows back and forth. So, you know, I could riff on this for the whole session, but in short, this is the stuff that has profoundly affected me and continues to affect me. And that's why I'm so jazzed on this stuff. Okay. I hope that helps. Great question. Okay. From David. All right. I'm going to fire through these, David, because there's a lot of them here. So I'm going to read them all and I'll ping as many as I can. What is your opinion of the usefulness of the currently offered program with Roberto Violdo and Bob Thurman on shamanic and Buddhist teachings on death called the Deathless Elixir of Immortality? Yeah, I saw that. I'm on his email list. I read it. Looks like a great program. Is this the best way to learn? I'll read these and then I'll come back to them because there's so many. Is this the best way to learn about the connections between the two traditions? What other options do you suggest? What is your impression of Alberto? What is your understanding of the shamanic teachings on death? What is similar to Vajrayana? What is different? How useful is it to understand them? Have you ever used ayahuasca and or psilocybin? How? Okay, you forgot to ask me, who do you think I expect to win the Super Bowl? So tongue in cheek, my friend, big warm hug, but you forgot to ask me. Hey, you know, somebody asked me this is no kidding. Like 12 years ago, I can't remember when. In a public setting, somebody asked me about the Super Bowl. I made just a totally off the cuff score prediction. And it turned out to be 100% accurate. It predicted the score of the Super Bowl game 3 hours later. Total luck. It was like, whoa, that's kind of cool. Okay, so a couple of things here, my friend. I don't know Alberto personally, but I do know him through my connection with Bob in the conference that I did last year with him. I think he's coming on again this year. I'm very impressed with him. If I can't say, my mom taught me this and I still maintain it. If I can't say something nice about somebody, I basically try to shut up and say nothing. Because, I mean, who am I? I mean, like, who am I to say anything about anybody? I mean, even if I had a negative opinion, I wouldn't share it. Everything I know about Alberto is beautiful. His talk last year, I was really taken by it. He's coming back. He's doing another talk. I'll have a chance to relate to him on that platform because I'm in that conference as well. That's the one that Alyssa's posted, by the way, in the chat. So Alberto seems like a beautiful human being. And if Bob is working with him, Bob does not suffer fools, right? And so that's all I need. If Bob is working with him, that's my seal of approval. The usefulness of attending that program, I can't tell you, but I bet if they're involved with it, it's going to be really good. Because Bob is just like, the guy's a near genius, right? So I think it's going to be awesome. I love the way they wrote that up. The wording on that really caught my eye. And I mean, I may attend it myself, but again, I can't guarantee anything. Is this the best way to learn about the connections between the traditions? I have no idea. What other options do you suggest? Well, read more about shamanistic traditions, of which there are tens of thousands, right? So Alberto represents one. Shamanism is a multivalent term that encompasses tens of thousands of different shamanic traditions. So can we say that they're all the same? There's no way. Different shamans relate to their shamanic journeys through their state and structural levels of development. And so even when you're talking about shamanic phenomena, I mean, good luck with that, right? There's tens of thousands of these. You might want to read the book by, maybe if Barry or somebody here can pull it up. I think it's called Civilized Shamans. and the author just escaped me, a wonderful scholar, but I'm pretty sure that's the title of it. So Alyssa or Barry, see if you can pull that up. I'm pretty sure it's called Civilized Shamans. Really interesting scholarly exposition on the shamanic nature of both the mostly Tibetan Buddhism, but I think also Bun Buddhism. They're intimately, inextricably connected. What other options do you suggest? I don't know. I'm not a shaman, right? I would probably suggest reading, what's his name? Samuels? You guys will find it. Civilized Shamans. I would recommend reading that book. What is my impression of Alberto? I don't know. What I heard, I was really impressed. What is your understanding of shamanic teachings on death? What I heard from him last year was beautiful, but he's a one voice in the chorus of tens of thousands, so I don't know. This is great. This is what Dafri John talked about as divine ignorance. It's like my favorite response. There's something quite liberating to just saying, I don't know. It's like, it makes me relax. Like, I don't know. So again, it depends on the shamanic tradition. What I heard from Alberto last year, I thought it was really spot on. Similar to Vajrayana? Yes, in some respects. Different? Yes, in some respects. So again, these are really, really big questions. Have I used ayahuasca and psilocybin? Yeah, again, these are massively big questions. I'm a huge fan of entheogens, psychedelics. I've completely changed my tune on these agents. I've explored them, but I don't think this is the venue to really go into that. I think they absolutely positively have a place. Again, I've completely changed my tune on this. I think if you relate to them skillfully, properly, with the right set and setting, motivation, I don't think it's facile to say you can look at them as a wrathful form of liberation, and therefore under the Tibetan tantric rubric, I think you can actually do that. But in terms of like that sort of thing, I don't think this is the appropriate setting for that discussion. Okay, and if you want to come on, really, anybody that I'm addressing a question to, you want to come on and have a little bit more back and forth, happy to entertain it. Good questions, my friend. Okay, from Arlene. Thank you. Yeah, nice words. I appreciate those nice words. I wonder if you can offer some advice on integrating the two wings of bodhicitta. Specifically, how can the practice of Tonglen be integrated with the illusory form practices? Okay, so this is a little bit more specific, kind of Tibetan Mahayana Buddhist thing, which is cool. Bodhicitta, awakened heart, mind. So Arlene, if you're there, I'm not sure if you taught, there's two wings. Are you talking about aspiring and entering bodhicitta? Or are you talking about absolute and relative bodhicitta? So it depends on which two wings you're talking about. There's actually four wings, right? That's why bodhicitta flies so well. It doesn't just have two wings, it has four wings, right? So let's just say you're talking about relative and absolute. How can the practice of Tonglen, specifically how can the practice of Tonglen be integrated with the illusory form practices? Well, that's an interesting question, actually. So Tonglen, the practice of sending and taking, remember there are four stages to it. The first stage is absolute bodhicitta, you flash emptiness. Stages 2, 3, 4 is relative bodhicitta. So when you're talking about absolute bodhicitta completely ties into illusory form practice. But then, Arlene, which type of illusory form practice are you talking about? Are you talking about impure, pure, or perfectly pure? So there's a lot of things here, like, okay, which types of two wings are you talking about? Which types of illusory form practice are you talking about? But if my intuition is accurate, the first phase of Tonglen, the absolute bodhicitta phase, you flash openness, emptiness, that's absolute bodhicitta. That's totally connected to illusory form, because emptiness is what actually brings about the entire journey from impure to pure to perfectly pure illusory form. So they're deeply, deeply connected. But unless I can centrifuge out with more specificity which one of the illusory form practices you're referring to, Arlene, which of the two or the four wings of bodhicitta you're referring to, I'm taking a couple of guesses. And if you're here and want to come on and suss this out with me, I'm happy to run with it. But otherwise, I'm just taking some guesses because I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. Okay, from Emily. Hi, Andrew. Last week you said when we die, we don't dissolve into oneness, but noneness. Reminds me of a really, really bad joke. Is this okay? Can I share this really bad joke? I have to think about whether it's appropriate. I think it's appropriate because you guys know I'm a goofball. And somebody told me this. So the joke is the following. Do monks have any fun? Have you heard this joke? Do monks have any fun? None. All right, deadpan, right? That's Stephen Colbert throwing out a joke where it just goes like what? Very profound. Actually, think about that joke. Okay. Last week you said that when we die, we don't dissolve into oneness, but into noneness. Well, the reason I said that, yeah, can you please elaborate? I always pictured my energy dissolving into the clear light. I'll no longer be me, but I'll be part of the boundless emptiness. Okay. Well, you're being dissolved into the ineffable, Emily. Even noneness, nothing can describe what you're going to dissolve into with complete authority. The map is never the experience, the territory. But the reason I went after the oneness thing is because of the near enemies that are associated with all the various forms of monism. And this is actually a subtle near enemy of even non-duality. Non-duality for a lot of people tends to assume a monistic oneness, but not really, because non-duality is a non-affirming negation. Non-duality doesn't affirm anything, but people tend to think that it's some kind of oneness. And yes, provisionally I get this unity thing, but it's not oneness and it's not noneness. It's ineffable. It's reality. And you can't put reality into words. The closest you can get, Emily, to understanding this doctrinally is through the luminous Bardo Dharmata teachings. And probably for a Westerner, the single best book on this is my dear friend Francesca Fremantle's masterpiece, Luminous Emptiness, Understanding the Tibetan Book of the Dead. If you want to learn about what you're going to dissolve into, read that book. Phase one is you dissolve into emptiness, not nothingness, but no thingness. But flip side of that immediately, that's phase one, is phase two, which is that's the phase one is the nothing phase. Phase two, which is subdivided into four phases, is the everything phase. So you dissolve into nothing, but that means you dissolve into everything. And take with that what you will, because that's trying to articulate the ineffable. You can't put this into words. You can only experience it. I always pictured my energy dissolving into the clear light. Yeah, we do that because that's the only way we can think. We think in terms of images and pictures and things. We think. But you can't picture this. Yes, dissolving into the clear light, that's a pretty accurate way of imagining what it's like. But basically clear light, in my book, Dreams of Light, is the entire book is about clear light. This is the way to talk about luminosity and emptiness. Clear is empty, luminosity is light. So you dissolve into luminosity emptiness. I'll no longer be me, totally true, you disappear, but part of the boundless emptiness. Yes, you can say that, but if you're only really, really, really careful, it's like, I like Bernardo Kastorf's analogy on this. Right now, we're dissociative alters in mind at large, and we're like whirlpools. I really like this image. And at the end, when we die, death is the end of the dissociation. It's the end of your localized contracted cocoon mind, where the whirlpool relaxes, opens, dissolves back into mind, into stream of consciousness, the stream of mind. So yes, you disappear. Well, I mean, you can disappear right now. You don't even exist right now. It's just that reality brings that out in powerful relief at the moment of death. You become part of the boundless emptiness. You're already part of the boundless emptiness. So you don't have to wait till you die to experience it. And same with the clear light. This is the clear light. You don't have to wait till you die to experience the clear light. This is the clear light. It's just that what basically we reify the light part, that's what we call matter. We forget the emptiness part. That's what creates samsara. So you are in the clear light right now. You just don't recognize it. When you enter the kind of baseline ground zero clear light, that's just basically when the display is returned to ground zero, to nothing. But this is the clear light. So that's why you don't have to wait till you die to experience this. So Emily, this is a really great question. And I don't mean to be too, glib and clever and smart alecky with my answers, but this stuff is really difficult. It's ineffable. It's super profound. Trying to use a dualistic medium to talk about non-duality, it just doesn't work. But if you really want to grok this, study the Dzogchen teachings, study luminous emptiness, read that book 5 times, then go into the meditations, do the practices, and then you'll discover this for yourself. Okay. All right. So here's I have a little bit of a bit of a challenge with some of these questions. Some of them come in, they're so long that literally for me to read them would take 5 minutes. And so I just, it's difficult because I don't have time to do that. And so some of these, if I don't address your question, it's just because it's too long. And so I apologize for that. I hope you understand. If you want me to, the best way to answer a question, again, is come on live, just for the purposes of succinctness. Keep it as brief as you can. But when I have one question that's two pages long, 1,000 words. I can't read it. It's just too much. I'm so sorry. But if you want to ask it and you're coming on live and you go, why didn't you answer my question? It's because I want you to bullet point it, be succinct, and come at it with something very direct. I apologize. I just don't have the time for it. Sorry about that. Okay, from Marion, during the pandemic, I had extensive liminal dreaming experiences that actually turned into a novel. I mean, how cool is that? That prompted me to investigate dream yoga. Nice. I've been a Theravadan practitioner for 20 years. Really nice. At age 75, I decided dream yoga practice made sense. Good for you. I think it makes sense too. In August, I took your course, Tricycle One. Okay, thank you for that. Read both my books. Thank you for that as well. It's very kind of you. I'm having some success with lucid dreaming, moving through the stages, and on occasion flying. Awesome. And even meditating in my dreams. That's even more awesome. However, far and away, my lucid dreams are still filled with my novel characters. That's great. Everybody's welcome at this banquet, right? I mean, that's beautiful. I'm doing my best to cultivate ways to control my dream content, the limited success. Am I being impatient? Okay, well, let me stop here. I'm going to say a couple things before I continue. The really cool thing here, and I'm sorry, Marion, is that just like dreams themselves, just like mind itself, there's so many different ways to work with your dream content. And by the way, when you're doing that, what are you working with? What are dreams made of, right? They're made of your mind. Conscious or unconscious, dreams are made of mind. And so there's so many different ways to work with mind as it expresses itself in a dream, lucid or non-lucid. One way is to basically, and it's a very powerful way, witnessing lucid dreaming, pellucidity, is to have a lucid dream. I had one like this last night, where the dream experience just continues to unfold as it would in a non-lucid dream, but you're completely aware of the fact that you're lucid. You just don't do anything. You sit there and you witness the whole thing like being in a movie. That's fantastic. That therefore allows the dream characters to come up. You don't interfere with them. The unconscious mind does a thing. You're just witnessing it with full lucidity. That's fantastic. Now, if you want to use that for creativity purposes, go for it. Great. See the dreams. I mean, see the novel, see the series. Go for it. If, however, you want to engage in more like transformative practices of dream yoga, because again, dream yoga, once you actually start to engage it outside of the pellucidity witnessing stance, then you have 8 stages at least of the transformative tantric aspects where you're changing the content of the dream. That's tantra. And then you have the last 2, loves 8 and 9 bleed into each other. That's sahajayana. That's the self-liberating aspect. And so therefore, if you want to work, it really depends on what you want to do with your dreams. If you want to cultivate more control over your dreams, then basically, what are you controlling? You're controlling your mind. Does that mean controlling the content? Yes, in some instances you can. That's the tantra transformative stage 2 through 8. But also controlling the dream, really in large respects, another option would be controlling your relationship. You don't have to change the content, change your relationship. That's another way to control your relationship. But if you want to do the classic dream yoga stages, then yes, then there's more of the kind of, I'm going to transform this into that, I'm going to do this to that, I'm going to work with that. That's fantastic. So the great thing is realize all the potentials, realize they all have a bandwidth of applicability. They all have a bandwidth of fruition and benefit. And then basically just see what works for you. If you're finding it really fruitful, really enjoyable, and you're, you know, writing the novels, I mean, that's beautiful, right? If you want to do more classic traditional dream yoga, that's really up to you. Then just engage in the classic stages 2 through 8, work with transforming dream content in that regard. That's another option. Am I simply being impatient? I can't say. You have to decide that. Should I simply go with these wonderfully creative experiences that appear so easily and allow the deeper levels of insight to arise on their own? I would say yes. I would kind of play with that because it seems to be what's happening now. And just celebrate, enjoy that. That's really wonderful. Eventually, because everything's impermanent, that may kind of taper off and transition, and then you can engage other bandwidths of dream practice, right? So there's so many different things you can do. I certainly feel the benefits of the illusory form practice in the waking state and hope to continue progressing toward the bardo and sleep yoga. Good for you. Any suggestions for influencing my dream content? Okay, specifically, yes, meditate. Work with generation stage meditations. Change the contents of your mind now through practices that allow you to work with not only establishing relationship to the contents, but changing the contents themselves. That's what generation stage practices are all about. And so if you're interested in that, and that particular, that if that language works for you, the generation stage yoga is also called Yidam practice, deity yoga. That's where you want to go. And in many ways, I really think that those practices come to their fruition, both in nighttime dream yoga and also bardo yoga. That's what those practices, because what do they do? Those practices purify birth. And what that means, it purifies the birth of the contents of your mind. So that's how it works toward literal ontological birth in the bardo yogas, but it also relates to changing, working with the birthing. This is a great line. See, let me see if I can remember this. This is a line from Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, I think. As imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them into shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. I mean, is that like the most beautiful thing, right? Amanda, you can correct I don't speak Oxonian or Shakespearean English, but that, maybe it's just an amazing thing. As imagination bodies forth, it's giving birth. Shakespeare is talking about generation stage meditation. As imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen, now this is not the poet's pen, now it's the yogi's pen, the yogi's mind, turn them into shapes. That's the voluntary rebirth thing. And gives to airy nothing emptiness, a local habitation and a name, a space-time coordinate. I mean, Shakespeare was some like Mahasiddha, right? This is the most amazing line. This is like unbelievable. He's talking about generation stage yoga here. So anyway, great question. If you're really into this, Marianne, generation stage yogas is where you want to go. Shakespeare. Okay, a couple more and then we'll go live, so to speak. Okay, from Deborah. Oh, here's a clinical one. Here we go. I've heard that mandibular advancement devices are contraindicated in periodontal disease. Whoa, now there's a face plant into the earth. That's like fantastic. Here we are talking about the Dharmakaya, and here we are, we're doing a face plant into periodontal disease and mandibular advancement devices. That's what I love about these gigs. We can talk about anything here. So yes, I have worked with this a fair amount when I was in clinical practice. Deborah, it depends on the extent of the periodontal disease. If you have refractory periodontal disease, then yes, you can't use the mandibular advancement devices. That's true. So everything here depends on the extent of the periodontal disease. If you have incipient class 1, 2, the mandibular devices are fantastic. And I mean, think about these things, right? If you know, these are big, full upper lower mouth guards. They cover all your teeth. So you're having a low distribution across your entire dentition. And therefore, only if you have really advanced, like flopping in the wind periodontal disease, it's not going to affect it. But I'm not going to go against your dentist, especially your periodontist. If you have that periodontal disease, consult not with your GP, but also with a periodontist So you don't get these kind of drifting things. But generally, that's pretty rare. Some of the bigger issues sometimes are TMJ related. And again, this is really difficult. It's also inappropriate for me to make these types of medical dental recommendations in a setting. I think you get the idea. I'll be asking my personal dentist about this soon. That's the most important thing to do. Very appreciate your thoughts and opinions. Yeah, again, without the data, without the probing DAS, without x-rays, I'm just shooting from the hip. Advanced periodontal disease, true. Incipient, early stage, not an issue. But again, if your dentist says otherwise, I'm not going to contradict that. In a recent Q&A, you mentioned you, or here's a total shift. You mentioned you're aware of at least 20, I'd say at this point more like 40, Western spiritual teachers who are not stably established in realization. I say that with a great deal of caution. Again, of course, because who am I? I mean, who am I to look across the room and say, oh, that spiritual teacher isn't? I mean, there's just no way. I don't know that. But I can tell sometimes by their behavior, right? I mean, again, I won't name names, but some of the things they do. I mean, there's no way. There's no way you can be stably realized and do these sorts of things. So I think it's fairly easy to infer they're not stably realized. Without naming names, definitely won't do that. Could you be so kind as to comment yes or no as to whether I include Dr. Feejian among them? Again, I'm really hesitant to do any of this sort of thing. I really refrain, again, because who am I? People look at me and will cast their dispersion. So what's the Christian thing? You know, he lives in a glass house, shouldn't throw stones or something. I'm not going to throw stones at anybody. Dr. Feejian, Dalavananda, this guy was a massive influence on my life 35, 40 years ago. I read everything, and his output is enormous, right? The Neo-Listening, the Don Horst Testament, Easy Death. I mean, the guy was prolific. He was a huge influence on my good friend, Ken Wilber. I think in his early years, everything he said made complete, utter sense to me. I was deeply impacted by his work. Later stuff, just didn't speak to me so much. But does that mean whatever? No, it means that maybe I wasn't relating him that much. So I'm very cautious to say anything about anybody along these lines. But the early stuff, I read every one of his books. He had a really big influence on me. I think I'll leave it at that. Okay, last one, and then we'll go live. Ooh, big one. You know, let me open this up because this is a big one, a long one. Then I'll come back to this if we have a little pause, because this one question alone will take 20 minutes. So anyway, sorry. Fire away, Elaine, and then I'll look in the chat column as well.
Hi, Andrew. Well, first, I signed up for your June retreat in Colorado.
Oh, at Bayou, the place is so beautiful. You will not be disappointed.
I'm so excited. It will be my first retreat ever. So.
Oh, cool. Oh, it's a good one. You're going to love it. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited. I wanted to chat with you a little bit about this dreamlike thing. I had a big slap of impermanence a couple of weeks ago when my otherwise seemingly healthy brother collapsed transitioned less than 24 hours later.
Oh my God.
And I'm having a shock. And so while we're going through this, even today, but especially at the hospital, you know, we're there and we're all saying, this seems so unreal. It's like a dream. And of course I had to think of you and the practice of going around saying, you know, this is a dream. But in this case, instead, you know, I had to tell myself, well, this isn't a dream. So I'm just wondering what you have to say about that. And so, in a situation like that with the practice. And then I had one other practical question for you.
Okay. So, well, first of all, I'm so sorry. I really,
thank you.
So, I mean, those are like, oh my gosh, I mean, that's like a, yeah. What can I say?
Yeah. Rug it's of your a, yeah, it's the first time I've lost anybody like that. And it was really, like you talk about, a lesson in impermanence. Wow.
Yeah. And again, it's difficult because I think you'll understand where I'm coming from. Sometimes with experiences of such emotional impact that it can seem almost patronizing and glib to start to insert, even retrofit, spiritual teachings and instruction, because it can seem like just dismissive of the harsh nature of what's happening. And so,
please, but I don't think that, or I wouldn't have asked you.
Okay, well, thank you. I was just going to say, with that in mind, I mean, these are among the most powerful, and I think that's where you're at now. If we relate to them properly, These are among the most impactful, potentially transformative teaching experiences we'll ever experience.
Right.
And because they're, unfortunately, they're just so real, right? And so what did the Buddha allegedly say? Of all the footprints, the footprint of the elephant is the deepest and most supreme. Of all contemplations, the contemplations on impermanence and death are the deepest and most supreme. Don Juan, right, used death as an advisor. There's just so many exhortations throughout all the wisdom traditions to basically look at reality in the face, realize the truth of impermanence, and use that to basically restructure one's life. And here's another really beautiful one from Milarepa, right? So this is a great one from one of his songs. In horror of death, I took to the mountains, contemplating again and again on the uncertainty in the hour of death. I captured the fortress of the deathless, unending nature of mind. Thus, all fear is over and done with. It's an amazing statement. And so without being patronizing and glib and spin doctoring it, if we relate to these things properly, they're a cold splash of reality into our face. They can restructure our priorities and help us look at things in a much more authentic way and therefore to live more authentically. So with that said, what I find here that's very interesting is that when reality is actually pointed out, this is so interesting. There's actually a particular ceremony in the wisdom traditions, and Tibetan Buddhism is called pointing out transmission, connected somewhat to Shaktipat in the Hindu schools, where Abhisheka, Wang empowerments, where through a number of different manners of rituals or methodologies, the nature of mind, reality is actually pointed out. And it's a seminal experience in any practitioner's life, because for the first time in an individual's life, they're literally pointed out the nature of their own mind. And it's when it's actually registered, it can be a life before and after experience. You're never see the world the same way again. And so the reason I mention this is the fact that you use the terms that the experience felt very dreamlike, kind of groundless. That is because reality was pointed out. And sometimes one way over the many decades that I've experienced this myself and with others, people often come out of these very powerful, transformative, potentially transformative pointing outs, and they'll often ask, they whisper to each other, say, did you get it? I don't know. Did you get it? Maybe. Did I get it? Well, one way to know that you got it is the world appears illusory. The world appears like a dream. And so the reason this is helpful is when you have these pointing out transmissions happen spontaneously, they don't have to happen ritualistically. They're actually happening all the time. And so the fact that you had this kind of groundless experience around something that's so real, that's a pointing out transmission. You actually had a spontaneous experience of what's called perfectly pure or illusory form, where you actually, because of the intensity of the experience, your reality was pointed out. And one way that's registered is like, this is like a groundless dream. And so again, if we relate to that properly, we realize, again, without being patronizing, that these things can be powerful blessings. And you've heard this, people get cancer, they have whatever, some major upheaval, some bardo, these are all bardo experiences. If you relate to those things properly, they can shapeshift your entire life.
Yeah.
So I'll pause there for a second to see if that's of any benefit before you ask your second question.
Oh, it is. It's and you know, talk about, I mean, I thought a lot about your teachings and the groundlessness. I mean, wow. You know, really, you really feel like the ground is pulled out from you.
You're in free fall. I mean, it only becomes disquieting if the experience is referenced to central headquarters. If you actually just hang out in that open space without reference, it's actually exhilarating. You become what's called a dakini, a sky dancer. But usually what happens is, because ego is not familiar with that much space, it contracts in ultimate self-defense. That contraction is what creates a fundamentally liberating open experience into panic and fear. And so, I mean, you know, famously, Trungpa Rinpoche said, right, the bad news is you're falling through space without a parachute. The good news is there is no ground.
Yeah.
So on one level, if you learn how to fly, that's what dakas and dakinis do. And it takes a little bit of practice. It's not easy because we're also habituated to ground. And that's what ego is. Ego is the archetype of ground. So I can simply say that honor, treasure that, treasure the memory, of course, in a very personal human way. But then, you know, whenever reality is pointed out like that, and we use these teachable moments, they can be lifesavers. It could be your brother's last gift to you, a gift of reality that you can then use to realign your life. What's important? What am I doing? What really matters?
That's good. That's all very helpful. Thank you. The other question was, while we were going through this and after he was extubated, and none of us in the family are religious, and it was so awkward. I just know that we missed a golden opportunity, I felt, to like help him. And because we just sort of stood around waiting for him to take his last breath. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering, is there a phrase? When I spoke with him one-on-one, I said things that I thought would be helpful. But as far as like, if this happens again, and there's a group, I mean, is there a phrase, a mantra, a little chant, something that, you know, could be an assistance to the one transitioning?
For sure. Absolutely. So for the purposes of time, I might recommend, and sorry for the shameless self-promotion, but my book, Preparing to Die, has sections on what to do before, during, and after death for yourself and others.
Okay.
Spiritual and practical perspective. And so in that book, I talk about all the many things you can do for yourself and for others when they're making that transition. And how long ago did he transition?
January 10th.
So not that long ago. So he's still in the 49-day period. So there's still a lot you can do for him. You can do.
I actually just got your book. So
yeah, look in there. And the other, there's so many wonderful things. You know, it's just not in my book. Tuku Tundib's beautiful book, Peaceful Death, Joyful Rebirth, has a ton in there. I mean, that's a little bit more hardcore Tibetan Buddhist. You can recite mantras for them. You can recite aspiration prayers for them. You can dedicate merit to them. There is a ton that you can do. And even after, you know, the longer they go, it's a little bit harder to make an immediate reach. But that doesn't make even years after the fact your work ineffectual. It makes it a little bit less effective, just because time and space relatively does kind of make these a little bit more difficult to actually implement. But there's a lot you can do. I don't know what your practitioner history is. If you recite mantras, you can virtually recite any mantra, like Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of compassion. You can do that now is like whenever you think of him, recite that mantra. And then at the end of every day, dedicate your merit to him. There's just so much. Because remember, you know, the world is not made of matter, right? The world is made of mind, heart, spirit. And so we can really help people on one level. According to the Bardo teachings, there's a provisional statute of limitations when the mind becomes cast, reified into a new form. But on one level, that statute of limitations doesn't apply at more foundational absolute levels. So there's a great deal that one can do, and perhaps the references can be of some benefit to you.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I will look at your book today. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate you very much, Andrew.
I appreciate your comments, really. Best to you.
Thank you.
Hey, David. Unmute yourself, my friend, and fire away. We still can't hear you. You're still muted. David, you're still muted. You have to unmute yourself. You're still muted. Yes, David, I can't hear you, my friend. You're still muted. You can write. I'll put you at the top of the list if you want to write your question in, but I can't hear you. And for my screen, you have a big red X over the mic, which means you're muted. David, while you're figuring that out, continue to play with it. I'm going to go to Arlene. You can always write it in, my friend. I'll put you at the top of the list. We'll come back to you. Okay. Happy to entertain you, but I can't hear you. Okay, thanks, bud. Hi, Arlene. Alyssa, are you there? You're not blocking them out in some way, are you, dear? Alyssa, are you there? Because I can't hear Arlene either. I wonder if it has something to do with my connection. Hold on. How about Amanda? I just want to see if I can get anybody at this point. Amanda, can I try you real quick? I'm in this hotel room. And I mean,
Can you hear me?
Is this Amanda?
No, this is Alyssa. Sorry. It wouldn't let me unmute, and it wouldn't give me the option to unmute anybody. So let me try again, David. It should work now. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, it's okay. Hiccup.
Okay.
There we go. Hi, David.
Now I'm here.
Yeah.
I've
sort of. You're not really there, but yes, you're sort of there.
Well, that could lead to a big conversation, just that. Some bogakaya. Okay. Well, anyway, so where I'd like to go a little bit further on my questions.
Okay.
Has to do with the fact that there are so many cultures and so many people that have so many different views about reality, and that and a lot of people say, well, that's my truth, and that's what it makes it real.
Sure.
And they also say that all these traditions have their own reality, and for them it is true, it's real as anything else.
Sure.
And wisdom traditions would be maybe a special category, because they spend a lot of time on this.
They think they're a special category. That's another question, but yes, maybe.
Well, exactly. I think we're on the right track here. So the question is kind of how to work with this. I'm connected a lot right now to someone who is more of this generic approach and wants to have their own personal perspective rather than adopting something else.
Sure.
And so they're waiting for angels and beings from Vega and all sorts of things to come along.
From Vegas?
Yeah, you know, Elvis Presley's going to parachute in with a mandala parachute.
Right, exactly.
He's going to spin it around. And it's gonna flash from the mandala into the wheel of life, you know. Doesn't he make it landing separately or not? But what boomy is he on when he gets to land? Okay. Some of this stuff seems almost at random, though. So it's a question of relating to it. What can one learn without being dismissive of this, so especially being dismissive to the point that one no longer has an open enough mind to recognize these differences, because, you know, we all reify things and we might think we understand what the Bardock Theodol says, but that's just our interpretation until we've experienced it in some ways.
Right.
So the question is like, how to go about relating with all this multitude of ideas about working with ancestors and so many different things that can be really helpful, but what do they have in the way of absolute truth?
Yeah, they're really great questions, my friend. So there's a couple of things that come to mind. This is a very rich arena. This is one reason I'm such a huge fan of integral theory and integral approaches. In fact, not this week or the week after, I'm interviewing John Dupuy, who's an integralist. I know him. He wrote this really quite okay book called Integral Recovery. And that book not only is it interesting in terms of recovery, substance abuse recovery, but it's also a really nice book because it has a very succinct summation of the integral approach. And so you'll see where this comes into play and how this can really help. What makes this whole thing so rich, so elegant, and also so bloody messy and frustrating is because we have all these different levels, lines, structures, states of consciousness that are actually taking place. And so let me just say a couple of things along these. For instance, if you just take structures of consciousness itself and its relationship to states of consciousness. So now you have two fundamental vectors. They're absolutely mandatory for understanding this. And so by this, what I mean is if you take just very briefly, because it's a really rich topic. You take something like spiral dynamics, the work of Claire Graves and Carl Beck and others, where based on the work of literally hundreds of very sophisticated cross-cultural psychologists, anthropologists, sociologists, structuralists, you cannot argue the data. There is a hierarchy, and just because there's a hierarchy doesn't mean it's a dominator hierarchy. They're not hierarchies in and of themselves. They're not fundamentally problematic. Sidebar, the difference is between a actualization versus the dominator hierarchy. So that's one issue. But the reason this becomes so bloody important is because you can have an authentic experience of the Dharmakaya, whatever you want to call the absolute. And then depending on your structural level of development, you will then, let's go from, you know, there's at least 10 degrees, and then they're in colors, you know, beige, red, orange, green, blue, turquoise, teal, ultraviolet. The colors are nice because they don't have all the implications of the names, archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, that people bring all their projections onto. And so, but basically what this means is, let's just take the Jesus principle. You can have a green Jesus. You can have a blue Jesus. These are all developmental structures. So you have a particular experience of something. And because of your indoctrination or whatever, your enculturation, again, 95%, think about this, 95% of what you do, this is the science, man. This is not like made up, is dictated by these unconscious processes. And that includes all these unconscious structures. And so people don't even know when they're fighting and killing for their red version of Jesus, that's just their interpretation of a particular experience downloaded through this lens, which is an archetypal blind spot. So this is an amazing set of teachings where all these different people, and you see this even within Islam, Shia, Sunni, I mean, even within the same tradition, they're freaking killing each other because they have slightly different variations of the same fundamental phenomenal experience. So with that said, the way to really bring some humility, openness, tolerance to this is study the fundamental aqua structure. Learn about states of consciousness, learn about structures of consciousness, then learns about lines of development. All the different, like Gardner's work, all the different lines, spiritual, musical lines, cognitive line. You have at least 11 different lines of evolution along all these stages. And they run along somewhat parallel tracks. They're not all like dovetailing into each other. And then on top of that, you've got the types. Then you've got things like Enneagram structures and all these different typologies involved. So you start to bring in all these factors that may seem like, oh my God, this is complex. Well, it's complex because the human condition is complex. And therefore people are coming at it from all these different lenses. And so I think this stuff is really important and helpful because it brings about a tremendous sense of humility and openness and tolerance and understanding. So that's number one. And then secondly, depending on how deep this person wants to go, then you have to go into the whole notion of truth, relativism, and the whole postmodern thing. You know, what is there such a thing as absolute truth? So you're talking about a set of questions, David, that are really big. And therefore, again, I would, to whatever extent this person has receptivity, I would direct them to some integral approaches to looking at reality, because it's a real eye opener. And you start to realize, you open your eyes to these, you open your mind to these, you go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. I was so blind to these vectors within myself, let alone my understanding of others based on these principles. So I'll pause there to see if this is hitting your sweet spot, but this is a big one.
Well, I might have to learn it well enough that I can slip things in subtly.
Exactly. You know, here's the thing with that as well. This is another reason why this stuff is helpful to know, because skillful means is not meeting people where you're at. Skillful means is meeting people where they're at. And so if you come in there with your thing, that's not going to help. The best thing you can do is really listen to them, respond to where they're at, and then maybe slowly work their way in. I mean, listen to Bernardo Kastrup. I can't remember where I read it. He had a very interesting riff on this in terms of how he, as an idealist, works with heavy-duty materialists to even approach a truth based on their completely reified, solidified viewpoints, right? So this is the definition of real skillful means, probably what it means. But a lot of it means shutting up, listening, opening, connecting to them where they're at. And then based on that, you can maybe find some ways to slide in and insert some teaching. So it's a really massively big, complex issue, but that's what comes to mind.
it's really big also in just in terms of day-to-day life. Like one has an idea of our world as something to just use, as opposed to something that's this conscious living.
That's an orange level. So if you go to spiral dynamics, that's everything first tier and down, where the world just becomes a natural resource. And only until you understand tier do you start to relate to the world. So developmental structures can really help you along that, right? People just have vastly different ways of looking at the world. Culture wars are born from this. Physical wars are born from this.
Climate wars.
Everything is based on our inability to have these kinds of understandings. So something like that, my friend.
Well, I think that's a good start. But I also find in my own self that I can have an experience in which everything makes sense while you're within the experience. And then later on, you start thinking, oh, so that the context of that makes sense within it. What does it make sense outside of it?
That's right. And that's postmodernism, you know, Foucault, Derrida, the whole post-structuralist things. But people, there's some pretty sharp people that have thought about this for a really long time, and you can learn a lot about these sorts of things. So I point you in those directions.
That's the names you mention again and again are your some of your core teachers, aren't they?
Well, they help. You know, I mean, they just make they there's a lot of explanatory power to these maps, right? You know, I mean, they're basically we're in prison, and these maps are really powerful if you want to make a prison break. So that's why they're worth studying. They really help us understand all these dark forces that are causing blindness within ourselves and others. And so this person who wants to strike out on their own way, I mean, that's fine, sure. Who are we to contest that? But what, you know, again, why reinvent the wheel, right? I mean, you can do that, but you're cutting through a lot of underbrush that's already been hacked through by other evolutionary pioneers. So anyway, I'll let it go at that because it's just such a big topic.
Yeah, that's why I trust the Tibetan Buddhist approach more than others, because
it's just one. I would trust it, but I wouldn't. Again, this is just me. I wouldn't put all your eggs in that basket. This is just me, totally me. Incredible skill set, incredible skillful means, but they have their own blind spots. Everybody has their blind spots. That's why you see this stuff that happens. So anyway, I don't. You know, I let it go for there. Okay, bud.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Hi, Arlene.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. Hi.
Oh, great. Hi, Andrew. So very good to meet you, albeit virtually. Thank you so much for all your rich, wonderful teachings. So you read my question earlier, and I just wanted to elaborate because you understandably were unclear by what I meant. Okay. When I referred to the two wings of bodhicitta, I simply meant compassion and emptiness. And so I wonder if you can offer guidance on how to integrate Tonglen practice with the recognition that nothing, including beings, do not exist as they appear.
Yeah, exactly. So again, just to phrase it in that, that's what I thought. So the wisdom part is the emptiness part, you know, the compassionate part is the luminous part. And so that's why, again, why you have those four phases of Tonglen practice, right? So the first phase, short, brief, is to remind you of the illusory nature of whatever arises. That you're going to take whatever happens seriously, but you're not going to take it that literally. Because otherwise what happens is when you step into stages, steps 2, 3, 4, you can go non-lucid to those. And then that results in burnout, that results in all kind of unskillful ways to relating with the phenomenal arising. So in relation, I'm not sure what else more I can say about that. You know, I think we can lose ourselves. It's very interesting. If we don't relate to compassion properly, it can transform to all these subtle gradations of idiot compassion. And so therefore, that's why Tonglen starts with the absolute bodhicitta end. So you always are reminded that, for instance, when you're doing Tonglen at a very practical level, you're not doing it. The universe is doing it. So the step one is saying, when I'm breathing this stuff in, no, I'm not breathing it in. The universe is breathing it in. When I'm breathing it out to benefit others, I'm not breathing it out. The universe is breathing it out. So the first step basically jogs our memory, puts it in perspective, and says, hey, wait a second, you know, in absolute framework, the emptiness thing has to be brought into play, because otherwise the compassionate thing can become unskillful. And so something like that, Arlene, does that help a little bit?
So I think so. So for example, when you practice Tonglen, you begin with the absolute view.
If you're doing it right, that's phase one. You just flash openness. Yeah.
And then, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the four phases. If you could just review them. Sure. So,
well, phase one is you fake it because you don't know. It's basically you open, expand to the ends of the cosmos. It's a way to decentralize. It's a way to work with wisdom, emptiness. And then the second phase is you start more abstractly, like the air conditioner thing. You breathe in the dark, you breathe out the light. Phase two is you become very specific, situation, person, animal, whatever. Breathe that in, and then send out light. Fourth phase is now you extend that not only to all beings on this planet, but throughout the entire universe. So everyone is what increased decentralization, which itself reinstates the emptiness thing. Each one becomes more open, bigger, and more expansive. But you have to have all four, otherwise it's not Tonglen. And people often skip over the first phase, rush to that kind of compassionate end. Yeah. And then that can become a bit problematic. So the first phase, even though it's brief, provides the groundless ground for the remaining three. It's actually quite important, super important. Okay. Yes, yeah, Pema Chodron, I mean, she's the queen on this, right? She talks so much about this, I think, in Start Where You Are somewhere. I mean, she writes about this all over the place. So check out. Okay.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Hey, Amanda.
Hi.
Hi. How did you like my rendering of Shakespeare? Was that okay?
I know, I'm gonna check it out. I didn't know where it came from.
I'm pretty sure it's Midsummer Night's Dream. Pretty
sure. Okay. Well, good. It inspires me to reread it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Following on from your response to David, I'm going to ask something about integrative, process and your experience with Tift? Bruce Tift.
Oh, yeah, my friend Bruce Tift, of course.
Yeah, great. Because I really think it's the way to do the combination of the developmental stage and then with the fruitional stage. Because what I'm coming up against a lot is that people, okay, they can go into the open awareness and this, and that, and the other, but they're very unkeen on looking at their fears, which come from the years 0 to 5. And they're very resistant, you know. And even in myself, I can see when I've got some stuff triggered, but I can kind of sit with it. But it's really important, this, isn't it? This first 5 years. I mean, what's your experience on this? Being too personal.
I mean, it's like everything, right? So again, from age, basically paraphrasing, from age 0 to age 7, we're mostly in delta theta wavelengths. Theta is the dimension of wavelength activity that hypnotists put you in to bring about hypnotic inductions. And so the implications are kind of staggering. Basically, from age 0 to age 7, we're hypnotized. We're basically installed with all these programs from our families of origin and whatnot. But then basically the entirety of our lives become printouts from those installations, just rehashing of those same programs. And that's why every therapist, every deep diver will basically take you back to childhood. And there's real reason for that, because that's where all this crappy hardware was installed. So it's a big deal. And this is where one of the major shortcomings of the classic spiritual traditions is they don't work in this world. They don't know, and no criticism, but they don't have the data collection methods or instrumentations to collect this kind of information. And so therefore it's massive, you know. So they'll tell you, okay, just meditate, do this and this. Fine, yes, on an absolute level, great. But sometimes you need just a different spectrum of tools to get in and unearth some of this kind of psychological stuff. And this is where I think there's massive blind spots in the spiritual traditions. They just have this kind of, dare we say, arrogance that it's an absolutistic approach that our teachings can handle everything. Well, of course, the minute you bring emptiness in, theoretically, emptiness can handle everything. But practically, it just doesn't seem to work that way. And so that, again, is why I like the Yano approaches, because they bring in all these different skillful means to say, whoa, I never really looked at some of this really deep developmental stuff. So it can just save you so much time and heartache if you just open your aperture, take in these other methods, use them to augment your own development, because otherwise, if you put all your eggs in any basket, that basket's going to break, in my opinion.
Yeah, but even with a lot of work, I mean, Bruce says that in his 40-year marriage, every day he experiences disturbance. I love that, disturbance. That's totally such a nice way to put it, with his wife sitting in front of him. I mean, you know, it's true that in spite of all the work, we've still got these deep wounds, haven't we?
Oh yeah, we all have these amazing traumas. I mean, look at the best-selling book in the New York Times bestseller for the last 5 years is Your Body Keeps the Score, right?
Yeah.
You got all
Bessel. This
stuff. Yeah,
Bessel. Yeah.
You got all this stuff jammed in there. And so that's why I take a lot of courage. That's why I take a lot of patience, humor, perseverance to bring all the stuff into the light of your awareness. And most people don't have no interest in doing that because it's,
you know, and then when you're in a relationship, then, you know, sometimes the other person can't do it, can't do the work, can they? It's a road less traveled, isn't it?
They'd rather be asleep. They'd rather be non-lucid. And that's why definitely the road less traveled, because most people would just prefer to be asleep. It's no day at the beach, right?
So with you, you use Bruce Tift when you get something come up that and like a blockage, and then he can quickly, you know, put his finger on it and clear it, and then you can move on.
Well, Bruce is brilliant, but he's not for everybody. He's a dear friend of mine. I think his book is brilliant, but he's very Vajra family, and this is no criticism. That's his strength. He's very cutting, very insightful, and sometimes that's too direct for people. But yeah, I think the basic premise of his book, Already Free, is spot on, and it's why I endorsed it so powerfully. It's a great read.
And do you think really, even now, someone like you who's done so much of all this work, do you think you do function 95% from your subconscious, as they say?
Oh, Amanda, I don't know. You know me. I'm still a piece of crap, right? I can't say. Maybe a little bit lighter, maybe a little bit less. I don't really know. But I think that's part of the individuation process is bringing all this stuff into the light of consciousness and frees you up. So what have I gone from 95 to 94%? I don't.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, by just being able to take a breath or whatever. Yeah. Okay. The last thing about Sam Harris and free will. Do you think we have free will?
No. Depends on who you talk to. So I used to subscribe to Sam's approach. I don't anymore, because I think it's limited. I think it has a particular bandwidth of applicability. You know, on one level, as long as there's a self-sense, there's no free will. Because the very self-sense is created by unconscious constructs. And the unconscious, I mean, like, when you're talking about free will, whose will is free? Yours? The ego? There is no you, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about ego, relatively, yes, you have the ability, veto power. You have free won't. On an absolute level, I mean, my friend Chris Wallace talks about this wonderfully. He says, on a relative level, you have no free will. On an absolute level, you, big quote, us, are nothing but free will. So on a relative level, no, there's no free will. We're basically, and even that, again, this is such a big topic, but we're just buffeted around by these massive contents of the unconscious mind. I mean, you think you're making decisions in your life? No way. Your habits are deciding for you. Those installation narrative loops from 0 to 7 are deciding for you. This is what decides the content of your dreams. This is what decides your choices in the bardo. Your unconscious processes decide 95% of what you do. But you clear that up, you liberate that stuff, then you become actually the expression of free will. But it's not yours anymore, see? So on that level, the free will is the will of the cosmos itself. It's not yours.
Mm.
But this is
so coming to more towards wisdom, is it? More towards wisdom?
Absolutely.
Hopefully.
Yeah, this topic has been debated, contested by philosophers, scientists, scholars for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I originally subscribed to Sam's view, but the closer I looked at it, it was a little too materialistic for me. And I think there's some real holes in it. I mean, the guy's brilliant, but that book, I don't know. I think it's a little bit more refined than what he's riffing on. So something like that.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Okay. All right, maybe, two more, and then maybe we'll be close to wrapping it up for today. Hey, Pramda Shariputra, fire away, buddy.
Yes, sir. A quick comment and then a question. Last time I asked about when you said of the skandhas, we identify with form exclusively,
mostly more than
the other ones. And I did some analytic meditation on with all five skandhas, and I came to the same conclusion that form is definitely one that I'm most fixated on. Probably the second would be thoughts, the fourth skandha, The one that I'm probably least can separate myself from is the stand of sensation. You know, yeah. I can say that, yeah, that's not me. That's a sensation. But anyhow, so that's my comment. My question is relates to high priests of scientism who have this fetish about materialism, and now they're trying to say that, okay, well, there must they're trying to flirt with this panpsychist idea of that there's some proto-consciousness in subatomic particles and some sort of fragmentary sense and all that, and yep. That's just completely ridiculous. But of course, you've said that everything is light or frozen light and all that. So then how do we separate that idea from this panpsychist delusion?
They're pretty big differences. So again, when you're talking about panpsychism, first of all, it depends on what kind. You know, most people, when they talk about it, they're talking about what's called constitutive panpsychism. But when you run into that, then you have what's called the combination problem, right? If you have these separate entities, that proto-consciousness is proto-awareness, consciousness units, conscious agents, you know, the work of, there's some really brilliant people working on this. Don Hoffman, by the way, we'll be bringing him on for an interview this summer. Don Hoffman, Federico Faggin, his consciousness units. So constitutive panpsychism is the one that's usually referred to. And then you run into this massive combination problem. So that doesn't really hold water. When you're working with the world being made of light, again, it's not physical light, it's the light of the mind. And then you have what's called the decombination problem, which is, okay, if you have this kind of, again, quote unquote, unitary mind, mistake, and again, those are in quotes, light world made of light mind, then how do you have the decombination problem? How do you get separate agencies, entities out of that? Well, this is Bernardo's fantastic work. Then you have the whole idea of dissociative alters. Dissociation is what creates the decombination, the illusion of decombination. So that to me just has so much more, it makes so much more sense to me than any version of panpsychism. I mean, panpsychism overtly or covertly still assumes materialism. And basically the idealists say yet. So, you know, I might recommend, if you're really into this, that massive trilogy, Irreducible Mind, Beyond Physicalism, and Consciousness Unbound, like 2000 pages, that goes through this in amazing, sometimes almost excruciating detail. But it's worth a slog, because then you start to realize the subtlety, the nuance, and how many people still have their particular pet theories that under a close analysis kind of just fall apart. So something like that, bud. I mean, that's a big one. I mean, some of these questions are really, really big, but.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Nice to see you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Hey, Mary, Jerry, and then maybe we'll call it after Jerry, and then I'll address some of the ones in the chat column and we'll be done for today. But go ahead, Mary.
Hey, really, first I'd like to thank you for having us. It's so nice to be part of a community. I have a question about in-person meditations, 3 days, week long, or longer. What do you look for when you're looking for, what would you think we should look for when we're looking for an in-person retreat? Just general, not necessarily dream yoga. Yeah. And then do you have any recommendations for continental US for this kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Where do you live?
Well, I live in Nevada. I'm asking for myself and also some friends who live on the East Coast. And if anybody in the chat wants to share their personal experiences, that'd be appreciated.
Oh, yeah, there's so many that are really awesome. You know, I mean,
great.
In the East Coast, you've got the Berry Institute, Jack, John, Goldstein. What's his first name? Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg. Amazing. I'm just amazing. You've got Wonderwell, I think, in Massachusetts, you know, Lama Willa and Liz Munson. I know them both. Amazing. Tons of retreat opportunities. Also Menla in upstate New York. Amazing.
M-E-N-L-A.
Yeah. Bob Thurman's thing. I mean, they all, Bob, screens and the people that work up there are all fantastic. So those are really, really rich places. On the West Coast, you know, you got Spirit Rock in the Bay Area. Those are the ones that are that are standard, like slam dunk safe for me. There's so many others, and so I'm a little bit hesitant, like omission. I don't want to leave out others, but those are ones I'm personally connected to some extent with and know about and can say, I mean, really good stuff.
Okay. That's really what I wanted. Yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
There you go. Welcome so much. Okay, fire away, Jerry. Yeah, Insight, Garrison Institute. Yeah, again, Garrison Institute is, it's a place where they just bring in all these different types of people. It's great, but I can't speak with any authority about the different entities that they bring in. The Barry Institute, Insight, they're the ones that really classically have wonderful, wonderful people there. Okay, Jerry, fire away, bud.
All right, just a quick comment. You know, like, I love these sessions. And I don't know if other people can see it, but on my computer screen, when you come on, there's like this ray of white that comes in from above your head and goes all the way down to your heart. So yeah. I don't know if that's something I'm just seeing.
Yeah, that's your pure perception. You know, I have this capacity, like, yeah, I won't go there, but yeah, whatever. Thank you, Jerry. I'm illuminating the universe. I appreciate that. Nice, kind words. Thank you, my friend. Always nice to see you. So let me see, there's a couple of things in the chat column to close it for today. Question on understanding ego. Generically speaking, could you compare my secular American basically green or higher developmental? Yeah, Wilbur, to say a Tibetan or Buddhist monk's ego. Oh, geez, again, I can't say. Ego is ego, right? Doesn't matter if it's Tibetan or whatever. Ego is ego. Ego is exclusive identification with form. And then basically ego becomes slowly de-reified as it goes up the spiral dynamics thing. Even at green, you have ego. It's only at second tier, teal and above, that you start to transition beyond ego itself. It's just less reified. So anything first tier from beige all the way up to green, they're still ego. And again, there's nothing wrong with ego. Ego is just a particular form of development. There's nothing wrong with it. Ego is just gets problematic when it becomes dominating and usurping of other approaches. So it doesn't matter if it's Tibetan, doesn't matter who you are. If you still have an ego, you're still first tier. And that's still somewhat arrested form of development. So I'm not sure where else to go with that, John. But, you know, again, read the work of Claire Graves, whole spiral dynamics thing, structuralism. Probably the best summary book on this, in my opinion, is Ken Wilber's Integral Spirituality. I think it's a masterpiece. Okay, here we go. In my humble experience, plant medicine, right? Psychedelics break a lot of head center spiritual methodology intelligence. I think that's true. Thank you. Your understanding is quite vast. I try. Channeling transmissions is also an interesting language of communication, which is not self-directed. Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. Yes, I think that's true. I agree. Yeah, Foucault. Boy, if you can handle him and Derrida, not easy. The post-structuralists are not that simple. Yeah, so some of these are just comments, which are nice. And here's the question that I didn't get to. Oh, here's from Steph. If death can be somewhat described as relaxing, opening our seemingly individual whirlpool into the undifferentiated, unqualified whole, how is it the traces of karmic habits that are the basis of new life continue to hold together in this way? That's where it's a limitation of analogy, exactly. If analogy is never the real thing, otherwise it wouldn't be an analogy, it would be the real thing. So in order to understand this, Steph, the Yogacara teachings on the eight consciousnesses is where you want to go. That's the best, most articulate map for what is it that continues. The stream metaphor doesn't really convey that. That's why you need more than one analogy, more than one metaphor. So it's the limitation of that. Okay. Do I have any experience with plant psychedelics and lucid dreaming? Yeah, so let me share this story. This is actually one of the really cooler dreams I've had the last couple of years. So this kind of blew me away. So I was in a lucid dream. And in the lucid dream, my avatar, my dream persona in the dream, took a psychedelic. I don't remember what it was. Ayahuasca, I don't know, psilocybin. But my dream avatar, I was in the dream and I said, geez, I wonder what would happen if I took a psychedelic. So I conjured up a psychedelic in the dream. I took it as a lucid dream avatar. And guess what? I started tripping. I mean, like, hello, talk about double placebo effect. So here I am generating my avatar. That's a mind construct. I generate the psychedelic, whatever it was. I consume it and I start tripping in my dream. Like, how wild is that, right? That was a really cool dream. Okay, can I get Bruce Tift on? We had an agreement to come on, and then he moved to California in San Luis Obispo, and we kind of lost touch a little bit. He said he was going to do it, but I haven't been able to tag him down. Do you really think we function from 95% of our unconscious? Absolutely, if not more. I'd say more like 98. In the theory of the first, not 5 years, Amanda, 7, setting up for future behavior, you betcha. Yeah. Okay. So unfortunately, I didn't get to Tim's question, his great question. I'm sorry, my friend. I think it was Tim. Just for the purposes of time, Tim had a really rich question about my three-year retreat. And I always get a little nervous when I talk too much about me, my stuff. But we're still going to dovetail it in, Tim. It's just that when these questions get so big, so long, they're great. I think you understand the challenge that I'm working with. You know, I kind of want to get through some of these other ones. So I apologize for that. But it's still on the list. And maybe if Alyssa is really nice, she can remind me next week and I can bump it up a little bit. So I hope you understand and can be patient with me. Because some of these questions, they're really great, but they're big, they're long. And in order to maybe let other people slide in with their Q&A, I have to let some of these at least slide. So I apologize for that. But in the meantime, thank you everybody for joining us. I didn't get the name of the brother of, I think it was Elaine's brother who passed, but we can dedicate the merit. Remember, if you believe in this sort of thing, everything we do here is not just for us. We dedicate all the merit to the benefit of all sentient beings. If you want to unmute yourself and turn your camera on, we can do this sweet, geeky little love fest thing. Otherwise, I'm back around next week when I get back in town. We'll continue with our usual escapade of adventures, and I appreciate everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.